Jack helped me walk to the bathroom. He had his arm around me. We walked between the beds.
Did you hear any voices?
The woman in the next bed was talking to her husband.
Anyone else?
A nurse.
Where?
Beside one of the beds. I didn't see her face. She was straightening the sheets.
What about her hair?
Dark. Long.
How was it styled?
It was tied back.
Look beyond her. What do you see?
A curtain.
Open or closed?
Partially open.
What else?
A woman. I think she'd just had a baby. Her family had come to visit, bringing flowers and balloons. They might have been Italian. Noisy.
Were any of them facing the nurse you saw by the empty bed?
I concentrate, trying to think back. The grandmother. She was looking in my direction. She apologized about the noise. My eyes flash open. She must have seen the nurse.
Perhaps, said Cyrus. It's worth talking to her.
Could I remember more if you hypnotized me?
I ask. There might not be any more.
In the same breath, I remember Simon, and suddenly change my mind. Cyrus seems to register the U-turn, but says nothing. I hate the way he uses silence like a lever and fulcrum, moving me to speak. Are you married? I ask, wanting to change the subject.
No. He smiles ruefully.
Why did you make that face?
I don't think I'm the marrying kind.
Are you saying?
I'm not gay, if that's what you're asking. I live with my girlfriend. She's a lawyer.
But you don't think you'll marry her?
My parents weren't a great advertisement for marriage.
Are they divorced?
They're dead.
I'm sorry.
It happened a long time ago.
Cyrus gets up and goes to the window, staring at the sky as though something has scratched at the edge of his memory. Why did she take Ben? I ask. He runs his finger down the glass.
It could be any number of reasons. Pedophiles are very age-specific and they don't usually target babies. More likely we're looking for a woman who cannot conceive, or who has miscarried or lost a child. She may be trying to hold a marriage together or to stop a relationship falling apart. A baby is her solution, something to paper over the cracks and keep a man from leaving her.
A lot of women have miscarriages.
You're right. And most of them learn to cope with their distress. Sometimes a person like this has a history of parental neglect. It could be a broken home or abuse. She may have been starved of love and is seeking a baby who will love her unconditionally.
You sound like you sympathize with her.
I understand her. She's vulnerable and damaged.
Will she hurt Ben?
Not unless she's backed into a corner.
So what now?
I draw up a profile and a media strategy.
What do you mean by strategy?
Whoever took Ben will be watching the news and reading the newspapers. She's listening. This means we can communicate. We can send her messages. We can keep her calm.
How?
By not treating her like a criminal, or demeaning her or making her frightened.
How does that help get Ben back?
We show her your pain. If she's lost a child, she knows what you're going through. We can use that.
Cyrus gets to his feet and picks up his satchel, swinging it onto his shoulder. He looks around the chair as though he might have dropped something, and then seems unsure whether he should shake my hand.
Try to stay positive, he says, without sounding patronizing.
I want to tell him the same thing, but don't know why. Then it dawns on me. Cyrus reminds me of the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz. He's not so much broken as in need of oil. Something has happened in his life that weighs down his steps and makes his movements creak and groan. Maybe that's the fate of someone who spends his life delving into other people's minds, listening to their worst fears, unmasking their flaws and discovering their motives. Maybe a man like that begins to rust or seize up, haunted by too many ghosts in the machine.
Agatha. I'm learning to cook. Up until now, poaching eggs and warming baked beans was the pinnacle of my culinary capabilities. But I want to show Hayden that I can be a good wife and look after him. Tonight, we're having chicken Kiev with green beans and honeyed carrots. Where are the chips? He asks. The recipe doesn't have chips. I like chips. Not everything has to be served with potatoes. He prods the chicken Kiev with his fork, but once he takes a mouthful, he scoffs a lot and asks for seconds. After I've cleaned up the kitchen, we cuddle on the sofa, flicking between channels on the TV. Rory is asleep, but he'll wake before midnight. Shouldn't you be expressing? Hayden asks, stroking my hair. Since when did you become the breastfeeding police? I reply, poking him in the ribs. Can I watch you expressing? I get embarrassed. Why? It makes me feel like a cow on a milking machine. I want to see. Maybe later. I take the remote control, mute the sound, and straddle Hayden's thighs, kissing him on the lips and moving my hips in tiny circles until I feel him grow hard. I lead him to the bedroom, whispering that we have to be quiet. Rory is asleep in his crib. What if he sees us? Asks Hayden. He's a baby. I kiss him again and slide my hand into his jeans. I love it when you stand to attention. We make love for the first time since he went away to sea. He braces himself on his arms, not wanting to lower his weight on me. Are you sure we should be doing this? He asks. It's fine. I don't want to hurt you. You won't hurt me. He's much more gentle than when we first met. Back then, he was like a rutting bull, pinning me to the mattress, as though trying to punish me for the wrongs of other women, girls who wouldn't sleep with him, or who dumped him, or who were out of his reach. Shouldn't we be using a condom? He asked. Shh. He begins moving, showing his urgency, yet trying to hold himself back. But I raise my hips to meet each thrust until I feel him surrender. He shudders and sighs, kissing my earlobe and whispering, I love you. My heart expands to fill every corner of my body, leaving no room for the creature or the doubts that it feeds upon. I fall asleep with Hayden's arms wrapped around me, truly happy. I know motherhood is hard, but I love this new gig. I don't mind waking at 4 a.m. to feed Rory, or getting hosed down while I'm changing his nappy. I don't care that he cries so often, or that he vomits on my clothes. Nothing is too big of a chore. I did 3 loads of washing yesterday. I folded, ironed, vacuumed, sterilized bottles and made formula. Between times, I locked myself in the bathroom and pretended to use my breast pump. Fatherhood has changed Hayden. He's softer and more caring. He does chores around the flat and volunteers to do the shopping, often taking Rory with him, strapped in a sling against his chest. There is nothing sexier than a man with a baby. It doesn't feminize or weaken him. It makes him look like a good provider and a role model, someone who will stick around. The Navy has given him 2 weeks paternity leave on full pay. After that, he's taking holidays, so we'll be together until mid-January, when he's due to rejoin his ship in Portsmouth. I wish he could stay longer. Part of me wants to hold on to this feeling forever, the newness and excitement. But another part is fearful of exposing myself and trusting too much. I'm not used to people staying with me. Normally, I prepare myself for disappointment, expect rejection, or assume the worst. I'm still cautious around Hayden's parents. I know that Mr. Cole likes me and Mrs. Cole is a besotted grandmother who hovers around Rory, making any excuse to pick him up and show him off. She's already planning a christening for the spring when Hayden is next home on leave. She wants to invite aunties, uncles and cousins. I've never had a big extended family that gets together at Christmas or for anniversaries, and sometimes this feels like I've stumbled into a Disney movie or one of those family sitcoms where the worst thing to happen is when someone burns the turkey or spikes the punch. We're visiting Mr. and Mrs. Cole for Sunday lunch, which is proper roast beef with all the trimmings, Yorkshire pudding, horseradish, baked spuds, gravy. Hayden's sister Nigella has come down from Norfolk, leaving her husband behind. but bringing a strange antagonism towards me. Every time I say something about pregnancy or childbirth, she makes a sniffing sound, as though she disagrees, but she doesn't follow up with a comment. When I try to chat with her about babies, she makes a snide remark about new parents being boring because all they can talk about is their children. I pull Hayden aside in the kitchen, muttering, "What's her story?"
"It's not your fault," he whispers. "She's been trying to have a baby and has miscarried twice."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"Nobody's supposed to know. Mum only just told me."
"What about your dad?"
"Totally in the dark, so don't say anything."
Over lunch, Mrs. Cole asks Hayden when he's going to make me an honest woman.
Agatha is honest.
"I mean, when are you going to marry her? A baby needs a proper name."
"He has a name," says Hayden.
"Not in the eyes of God," says Mrs. Cole. "Otherwise, people might think he's a..."
She doesn't finish the statement.
"People don't care about stuff like that anymore," says Hayden, looking uncomfortable.
I interrupt. "If we get married too soon, people will think it's only because of Rory. By waiting, we show them that we're really in love."
I squeeze Hayden's hand.
Nigella makes a gagging sound like she might throw up. I feel my hackles rising.
When the table's been cleared, we retire to the parlour. Hayden turns on the TV to watch the football. The news is showing another story about baby Ben.
"Oh, I didn't tell you," says Hayden. "Agatha knows Meg Shaughnessy."
Mrs. Cole is pouring tea.
"Who?"
"Baby Ben's mother."
The whole family looks at me.
"We did yoga together when I was pregnant," I explain.
"And you visited her house," adds Hayden.
"What's she like?"
asks Mr. Cole.
"She's really nice."
"Her husband's a bit handsome,"
says Nigella, picking polish from her fingernails.
"They've two children, Lucy and Lachlan. They're 6 and 4, I think."
"That poor woman," says Mrs. Cole.
"Is their house nice?"
"What difference does that make?" sniffs Mr. Cole.
This puts her back up.
"Well, him being on TV, I expect they have a very nice house."
"Very nice. 4 bedrooms. It's in Barnes, not far from the river," I say. "It's close to where I used to work."
"Where did you work?"
asks Nigella.
"In a supermarket."
"A supermarket?"
She makes it sound like a leper colony. The TV is showing CCTV footage from the hospital. A grainy figure in a nurse's uniform is walking away from the camera, turning and entering a lift. The frame freezes, and the camera switches to a close-up.
"She looks like you, Agatha,"
says Nigella.
"Me?"
"Yeah."
"She looks nothing like her," says Hayden defensively. Mr. Cole leans closer from his armchair.
"She does a bit."
I feel my chest tighten, but manage to laugh.
"You're right."
"Your hair is shorter," says Hayden.
"I could have been wearing a wig," I say.
"You have the same shaped face,"
says Nigella.
"It wasn't always this round. Pregnancy bloated me."
"You're not bloated," says Hayden.
"No, but I could lose a few pounds."
I sense Nigella smirking from the other sofa. The TV is showing a picture of Meg and Jack leaving the hospital.
"So, who do you think took baby Ben?"
asks Mr. Cole.
"Probably someone who couldn't have her own baby," I say, watching Nigella stiffen. Sometimes, when a woman miscarries or can't get pregnant, she loses the plot.
"Maybe we should change the subject," says Mrs. Cole.
"I'm not saying all women, just some of them. They grow bitter and jealous. I feel sorry for them."
Nigella excuses herself and leaves the room, holding her hand over her mouth.
"Is she all right?" I ask. "Did I say something to upset her?"
Megan. Dozens of reporters are milling outside the house, blocking the pavement and taking up parking spots with their broadcast vans and satellite trucks. Our rubbish bin is overflowing with their coffee cups and fast food wrappings. Jack has to park around the corner, and we run the gauntlet of the TV cameras, flash guns and boom microphones. Lisa Jane tries to force a path through the scrum, yelling at reporters to stand back.
"Mr. and Mrs. Shaughnessy have nothing to say. If you don't get out of our way, I'll have you arrested,"
I'm not going to ask again.
Recording devices are thrust into my face. Questions are shouted. Someone touches my arm. I pull away as though scolded. A female reporter forces a letter into my hand. Without thinking, I take it from her.
We can offer you more,
yells someone else.
Don't trust her,
a third person replies. Lisa Jane is calling for backup on her shoulder radio. We're nearing the front gate. Jack has his arm around me. I can feel that he wants to lash out at someone or scream abuse, calling them ghouls and pariahs. But he works on TV. He knows how the media operates. We reach the front door and the sanctuary of the hallway. A final letter is thrust through the letterbox, and the noise abates. Lisa Jane promises it won't happen again. Jack grunts in disgust and disappears into the back garden. I go upstairs and unpack my bag from the hospital. Among the nightdresses and pyjamas, I discover the baby clothes that Ben was supposed to wear home. I lay the tiny outfit on the bed, trying to imagine my Ben is here with me, watching me unpack. Lucy and Lachlan have been staying with my parents. I miss them. Their voices, their mess, their arguments, and their hugs. I walk from room to room, all of them familiar, yet somehow they're not the same. They're darker and colder and devoid of colour. In the newly painted baby's room, I run my fingers over the nursery rhyme stencils and spin the mobile above the cot, watching the hand-painted African animals circle above the mattress. The rocking chair in the corner was a gift from my parents when Lucy was born. Lachlan's favourite blankie is washed and ironed on the polished wooden seat. He donated it to the new baby when I told him he was too old for such things. Picking it up, I hold the frayed blanket against my cheek, remembering how Lachlan carried it everywhere with him. Moments later, without realizing how, I'm kneeling on the floor, pressing my face into the blanket and sobbing like a child. Lisa Jane yells up the stairs, I've made a cup of tea. I'll be down in a minute, I say, wiping my cheeks. I wash my face in the bathroom. In the mirror above the basin, I see a stranger with red-rimmed eyes and lank hair. I try to find physical signs of my bereavement, an extra line on my forehead, or scarring on my skin, or a missing limb. Losing a baby is so fundamental and shocking, surely there must be tangible evidence. I can feel the hole inside me. In the mirror, I notice the edge of the bathtub, where a menagerie of animals is lined up, as though waiting for Noah to arrive. Cows, ducks, sheep, horses. One of Lachlan's trucks is resting in the plug hole. The shelf above is stacked with baby shampoo, bubble bath, bath bombs, and more toys. There's a tap on the door. Lisa Jane. Are you all right? Fine. She's listening at the door. I can hear her breathing. After a while, she leaves, and I'm alone again. Sitting on the edge of the bath, I try to count the minutes since Ben was taken. How long did I spend with him? How long has he been missing? Would I recognize his cry or his smell? Would I recognize him at all? I can't remember the color of his eyes, or the size of his feet, or the length of his eyelashes. Jack has gone by the time I get downstairs. He said he had something to do, says Lisa Jane, who has pinned back her blonde hair like a gymnast. Is everything okay between you two? We're fine. In truth, I feel less anxious when Jack isn't around. We've barely spoken in the past few days, and I cannot look at his face without seeing my own fear reflected in his eyes. Lisa Jane is going to stay to make sure we're not bothered by reporters or strangers knocking on the door. She'll sleep in Lachlan's room. DCS McAteer suggested we book into a hotel, away from the media. But I want to be home, lying awake in my own bed. I know it's ridiculous, but I imagine that Ben is going to call me, or find his way home by himself, which is why I have to be here just in case. Opening my laptop, I begin reading the dozens of emails in my inbox. There are messages of support and sympathy, offering prayers and best wishes. Many of the names I recognize. There are teachers from Lucy's school and Lachlan's preschool, mothers from my mother's group, and old friends from university and my magazine days. I read a selection of them. Nobody seems to know what to write. Agatha's name is on the list.
Hi, Meg. I heard the news. I'm shocked. Horrified. I can't believe this has happened. I feel guilty about my own happiness, because I know how difficult this must be for you. If there's anything I can do, if you need a shoulder or a friendly face. Thinking of you. Agatha. Kiss, kiss. Almost immediately, she sent a second message.
Meg, it's me again. I just wanted to say that I'm sure Ben will be fine. Whoever took him will be looking after him. This will all work out. Kiss, kiss.
I want to be charitable about all these messages of support, the offered prayers and heartfelt sympathy. But instead I find them irritating and self-serving, as though the authors feel better about themselves for having been in touch. I know that's unfair. What would I do in their situation? The same. I look at my mummy blog. One of the newspapers revealed my blogging career, quoting some of my posts. Now my followers know that Cleopatra is Megan Shaughnessy and Jack is Hail Caesar. The news has triggered hundreds of comments, most of them expressing sympathy and shock. Who are these people? They don't even know me. They've read a few blog pieces about my family foibles and daily tribulations, and now they feel invested in me. But instead of being comforted or encouraged, I feel angry. They have no right to claim ownership of my feelings or my ordeal. A woman from Norfolk claims she saw Ben in a dream and that he's alive and living with a family of gypsies in Dorset. A different woman, a clairvoyant called Carla, says that if I send her a sample of Ben's placental blood, she'll conduct a séance to find him. A man called Peter from Brighton writes about a vision. Ben is somewhere near water, he says, next to an old barn. His vision also contained pigs, a citron, and a milk tanker. I begin deleting their messages, but stop myself. I don't believe in ESP or tarot cards or any sort of psychic phenomena, but I cannot bring myself to close off any possible lead. The doorbell rings. Lisa Jane answers it. She's talking to someone, telling them to leave. It's most likely a reporter. Moments later, she appears at the bedroom door.
Someone called Simon insists on talking to you. He says he's a friend.
My stomach flips over. I don't want to see him.
Okay.
She's halfway down the stairs when I change my mind. I want to know why he's here and what he's planning. I call after her.
Let him in. I'll be down in a few minutes.
I brush my hair and put drops in my eyes to take away the redness. I don't know why that's important, but I refuse to crumble in front of Simon or show him any weakness. He's in the sitting room, standing at the window, looking through the curtains at the reporters outside. Dressed in a crumpled linen jacket and tight jeans, his two-day growth is flecked with the first traces of grey, but he's not self-conscious about it yet.
"What do you want?"
I ask, not hiding the chill in my voice.
"I was worried about you."
He glances back to the window.
"It's a zoo out there."
"Are you one of the animals?"
"Give me some credit, Megs."
"So you're not working?"
"No."
He runs his finger along the mantelpiece.
"Where's Jack?"
"Out."
"You didn't have to put him through this."
"What?"
"Jack, he doesn't deserve to suffer like this. Neither of us do."
My look of puzzlement seems to confirm his suspicions.
"You're very good, Meg. Quite the actress."
"What are you talking about?"
"You could end this right now. The whole circus. Simply tell the police what you did with the baby."
I stare at him in disbelief, aware my mouth is open because my tongue has gone dry.
"I remember what you told me when we last spoke,"
he says, picking up a framed photograph of Lucy and Lachlan.
"You swore on your baby's life that I would never see the child, never hold him in my arms."
"You think I did this?"
"Convince me you didn't."
I'm so angry, my eyes are swimming.
"You think I orchestrated the abduction of my own baby?"
"You could be arrested for wasting police time,"
says Simon. Children's services will take away Lucy and Lachlan. You'll lose everything.
Simon, Simon, Simon,
I say, sighing and shaking my head.
Tell me how I managed to smuggle my own baby out of a hospital when I'd just had surgery.
Maybe you cooked it up with your sister. Grace came to see me, by the way. She threatened to expose me as a drug dealer.
That's wrong. I'm sorry. But if you think I did this, you're crazy.
Am I? Maybe you hired someone. You paid them to take the baby and keep it safe.
Really? Who did I pay?
He shrugs his shoulders as though it doesn't matter.
You think I paid someone to dress up as a nurse and take Ben? How long are they supposed to look after him? A week? A month? A year?
Don't be an idiot. Simon's resolve is wavering. You can't wish me away, Meg, and you can't hide your baby forever.
Get out!
You're giving me no option. I'm going to take my concerns to the police.
They'll laugh at you.
Jack won't be laughing.
I slap him hard across the face. That's the second time. Clearly Simon has a face that deserves to be slapped. I want to do it again. I want to claw at his eyes. I want to wipe the smug look off his face. Get out! Get out!
Lisa Jane has come to the door, drawn by our raised voices.
Is everything okay? I want him out of my house!
I scream. I was just leaving, says Simon, pushing past Lisa Jane. He's in the hallway and out the door, which I lock behind him, latching the security chain. Afterwards, I sit at the kitchen bench. Lisa Jane fetches me a glass of water. My hands are shaking. Water spills. She's waiting for an explanation.
I want you to keep that man away from me. Away from my family.
Why?
He's trying to blackmail me.
What? How?
It doesn't matter.
How is he trying to blackmail you?
Forget it. Just keep him away.
Agatha. Rory had a difficult night, crying and grizzling. He wasn't hungry or wet or running a temperature, although I think he should be feeding more. I weighed him this morning using the bathroom scales. I know it won't be very accurate, but I'll do it again tomorrow and the next day until I get some idea if he's putting on weight. I look a mess. I have bags under my eyes, and my face is fat for no reason. I hate it when that happens. I hardly ate anything yesterday. I didn't pig out on cakes or chocolate biscuits. On days like this, I look in the mirror and see my true self, a monstrous creature who belongs in a freak show. Instead of smooth skin, I see scars, wounds, and runnels that are carved or bulging in my flesh. Hayden also didn't sleep, which puts him in a foul mood. He complains when I boil his eggs for too long and burn the toast. Later, he criticizes how I iron his shirt. I knew the honeymoon couldn't last. Already he's growing tired of me. Once the novelty wears off, he'll realize that he could have done better. We'll begin fighting over little things, and I will test the bonds of his love, because I doubt their strength. I will demand more of him, daily proof, and this will drive him away. Why do I do that? I am my own worst enemy. Every time I risk being happy, I find a way to fuck things up, because deep inside, the creature twists and slithers, gnawing away at my self-belief, reminding me of my past failures, my other babies, the bodies in the glade. Deep inside, I know that I don't deserve to be loved. My phone is ringing. I don't recognize the number. Hello?
Agatha?
Yes?
It's Nikki. It takes me a moment to put the name and voice together. I haven't talked to my ex-husband in 3 years. Every Christmas he sends me a group letter telling me his news, which is how I know that he married a divorcee from Newcastle and became stepdad to 2 boys.
Nikki, what a surprise. How are you?
I'm good. And you?
The same.
An alarm is sounding in my head. Why is he calling me now? We both pause and then start talking at the same time.
You first, I say.
I'm down in London for a conference, and yesterday I bumped into Sarah Derry. You remember her? She worked at your temp agency.
Of course. Where is he going with this?
We were chatting away, and she suddenly dropped a bombshell. She said you'd had a baby. Congratulations.
Thank you.
A little boy. I was amazed. I mean, I thought there must have been a mistake.
Mistake?
He hesitates and changes direction. It's brilliant. You must be so happy.
Yes.
Another long pause, even more uncomfortable this time. Can I take you to lunch? He asks.
I'm pretty busy right now.
Of course. How about a coffee? I can drop round. I'd love to see the baby. I don't want him coming here. Hayden doesn't know about Nicky. He doesn't know that I've been married and divorced or spent years trying to have a family. I hear a sound behind me. Hayden is standing in the kitchen doorway. He mouths the words, "Who is it?"
"Nobody,"
I whisper. Nicky is still talking. I want to hear how you managed to get pregnant after all those attempts. Remember that last fertility specialist? He said you couldn't conceive again.
He was wrong.
Obviously.
He doesn't believe me.
I'm free now. I could come around. I have your address.
I've moved.
Really? Your mother said you were at the same place. My heart skips.
When did you talk to my mother?
In August, on her birthday. Are you still in Fulham?
No. Yes.
Hayden is watching me.
I've changed my mind, I say. Let's meet somewhere.
Great. I have a meeting in South Kensington. I can meet you afterwards. Is that okay?
Nicky names a place, and we agree on a time.
Make sure you bring Rory. I want to meet this miracle baby.
How do you know his name?
Sarah told me, of course.
He laughs. I end the call quickly. Hayden is standing over me.
Who was that?
An old friend.
A boyfriend?
No, not really.
What does that mean?
He's a friend of the family, a pseudo-uncle. I haven't seen him in years.
So you're meeting him?
For coffee.
Can I come?
You'll be bored. How about you take Rory to your mum's? She'll like that.
The restaurant is one of those hole-in-the-wall places in South Kensington that defy physics by being bigger on the inside than the outside. There's a bar along one wall, opposite a series of booths. Further from the front, the restaurant opens out into a large dining area overlooked by a mezzanine level. By day, it serves coffee and cream teas. At night, it becomes a tapas bar. Nicky hasn't changed much. He's a little greyer around the temples and has put on a few pounds. The extra weight makes him look more feminine because it sits on his hips.
You didn't bring the baby,
he says, sounding disappointed. No, he didn't sleep well last night.
Shame.
Nicky takes my coat and hangs it up for me, before summoning a waitress to take our order. It's strange, sitting opposite my ex-husband after all this time, hearing his voice again, which sounds so intensely familiar, but also foreign, because it belongs to a past life. Unlike Hayden, who is quiet and moody, Nicky is cheerful and expressive, wearing his heart on his sleeve. We're not far from the Victoria and Albert Museum, and tourist coaches are parked along the road outside. Workmen are putting up Christmas lights, stringing them from overhead wires that are threaded between lampposts and trees. Come nightfall, the wires will disappear in the darkness, and the lights will make everything look festive and bright.
So, how did you do it?
Asks Nicky, not dropping his gaze.
Do it? Get pregnant?
It just happened.
Really?
His eyes are so intense it's like he's wearing makeup. If you must know, I used a donor, I say angrily, before apologizing. Sorry, I don't want people knowing.
Why not?
I shrug. It's simpler.
Your mother didn't mention you were pregnant.
I didn't tell her until the third trimester. I didn't want to get her hopes up. Not after what happened the last time. Nicky's eyes cloud over with sadness, and he takes a moment to compose himself. Our coffees have arrived.
Are you with someone?
He asks. Engaged.
Good for you.
I tell him about Hayden, playing up the Navy angle, making it sound like he's destined to captain his own frigate, or be Vice Admiral of the fleet. We're going to get married in the summer, and honeymoon in Tahiti.
Tahiti? Wow. So he's the biological father?
Yes, I reply.
Nicky folds and unfolds his serviette. The story about the stolen baby, such a terrible business.
I haven't been following it closely.
His eyebrows lift. It's hard to avoid.
I have been rather busy of late, I laugh,
not meeting his gaze. Yes, of course. Nicky begins talking about how he drove past our old house in Highgate. I think they've done an attic conversion, he says. We always talked about doing that. When we had children. He looks at me apologetically, wishing he could take the statement back. Do you ever wonder what would have happened if our Chloe had lived? She would have been 4 this year. I don't answer. I wonder all the time, he says. I see a little girl in the street or the park, and I imagine that she might be our Chloe, alive and well, being raised by someone else. If I thought that, I'd go crazy. You're right. We both went a little dippy, didn't we? I remember you talking about stealing a baby. You were kidding, I know, but you said we should find a couple who already had children and take a baby from them.
I was grieving.
Of course.
I managed to hold Nicky's gaze, when all I want to do is look away. The creature inside me uncoils.
He knows. He knows. So where did you have your baby? Nicky asks.
In London.
Oh, Sarah said it was in Leeds.
What I mean is, I gave birth in Leeds but came straight back to London. Hayden had just flown in from Cape Town. He's been fighting pirates in the Indian Ocean.
Nicky tilts his head. I was in Leeds a few weeks ago. I knocked on your mother's door. The place looked closed up. A neighbour said she'd gone to Spain for the winter.
She came back for the birth.
And then went back to Spain.
Yes.
He knows. He knows. I look at my watch. I'm not wearing one. I glance at my phone.
I really have to go. Rory has to be fed.
Sure. Absolutely. Nicky gets up and holds out my coat while I slip my arms into the sleeves. It was lovely seeing you again, Aggie. Look after that baby.
I will.
We separate on the pavement outside. I walk 2 dozen steps and look back. Nicky is still watching me.
He knows. He knows.
He returns my wave before crossing the road, heading for the nearest underground station. When he's far enough ahead of me, I turn and follow, keeping my head down and weaving between pedestrians. Nicky is tall enough to spot in a crowd.
He knows. He knows. He won't say anything.
He'll tell the police.
He has no proof.
It doesn't matter. South Kensington Station is always busy. There are multiple walkways and passages leading to different platforms. Keeping Nicky in view, I pull up the hood of my coat, shielding my face from the cameras. At one point, Nicky pauses to give money to a busker playing the violin. I stop suddenly and turn, walking against the flow. After a few seconds, I spin back and follow him again. He has reached the eastbound platform of the District and Circle lines, which is crowded with sightseers leaving the museums. Murmuring apologies, I brush past shoulders and weave between bodies, following Nicky to the far end of the platform. I glance at the information board. The next train is a minute away. Nicky is looking at his phone.
He's calling the police. He could be reading emails.
Or sending a message.
It's nothing.
He's jealous because you couldn't give him a child.
Nicky loves me.
He knows. He knows. The train is approaching, beating out a rhythm on the rails. Images flash against my closed lids. I see the police arriving at the flat. I see them taking my baby away. I'm fighting at their arms, begging them to give him back, to let me hold him. Nicky is shuffled forward, standing close to the edge. I'm right behind him. Close enough to see the fine, downy hair on the nape of his neck and the dandruff on his shoulders. People are pressed around us.
He knows. He knows. What can he do?
He can tell the police.
No.
The wind lifts the hair from Nicky's forehead as the train appears, rushing towards us. The front carriage is 40 feet away, 30 feet, 20 feet. I glimpse the driver behind the windshield, a man, looking bored.
He knows. He knows. What can I do? Stop him. How?
My hands touch the middle of Nicky's back. His head begins to turn, but I push harder, feeling his weight. Giddy for a moment, I muffle a laugh as he pitches forward, fighting for balance, waving his arms in tiny circles. For a moment, he seems to defy gravity. But then he falls, disappearing beneath the train with a soft whoomp, a sound repeated with every passing wheel. A woman screams, then another. I join them. People are shouting as carriages flash past us, slowing to a halt. Passengers are standing inside, waiting to get off, unaware of what's happened beneath them. A pudgy girl of 5 or 6 is staring at me. She's holding a doll in the crook of her arm and tugging at her mother's sleeve. Her mother covers her eyes, telling her not to look.
"What happened to the man?"
asks the girl.
"Shh! Where did he go?"
The girl pulls her mother's hand from her face and stares at me accusingly. I cannot meet her gaze. I turn away and move through the crowd. People are pressing forward, hoping for a closer look. Others want to escape. I push past them, weaving between the forest of shoulders, keeping my head down, listening to their conversations.
"Someone jumped! He collapsed. Shit! Are we going to be late?"
It seems to take an age to reach the exit, the stairs. My hands are shaking, my mind numb. I must think clearly. If I leave the station, it will look suspicious. I should catch a train, choose a different platform, get away, cover my tracks. The creature inside me has gone quiet. But I know what he's thinking. He knew. He knew. He knew. Megan. Lucy and Lachlan race each other through the front gate and down the path, hurling themselves into my outstretched arms. Flash guns are firing, and TV cameras capture the moment. Our private family reunion has become public fodder, to be shown and reshown on every news channel. We are the stars of our own reality TV show, Meet the Shaughnessys. Jack follows them down the path, carrying their twin suitcases. The photographers are yelling instructions, wanting us to pose for more shots, but I shoo the children inside and we shut the door. I hug the children again, properly this time. Lucy talks, trying to tell me all her news before Lachlan has time to construct a sentence.
"I think I have nits. My head's all itchy. Grandma gave me a special shampoo, but it hurt my eyes and I had to wear conditioner on my head for ages. I cried when she combed it out, but she didn't find any nits. So how come my head is so itchy?" "I'm hungry," says Lachlan.
"I'm making a snack now," I say. Lucy crawls up onto Jack's lap. Lachlan comes to me.
"Did you have the baby?"
Lucy asks. "Yes, a little boy." Lucy frowns.
"I was hoping for a girl."
"But you knew we were having a boy."
"Yeah, but I thought maybe you made a mistake or changed your mind. Like that time we ordered that lamp from IKEA and picked up the wrong one, and we decided that the wrong one looked better than the right one, so we didn't take it back."
"Babies aren't like lamps from IKEA," I say.
"So where is he?"
asks Lachlan.
"Can we see him?"
"Not just yet."
"Why?"
I look at Jack. We've already discussed how to handle this. "Ben has gone missing," I say.
"I knew it," says Lucy triumphantly. "I heard Grandad and Grandma talking. They said someone stole him."
"That's right," says Jack, "but we're going to get him back." Lachlan frowns.
"Why did they steal him?"
"They must have wanted a baby," replies Lucy,
making it sound so logical.
"But you can't just steal one," says Lachlan.
He looks at me for corroboration. "The police are looking for him," I say. "That's why all those people are outside the house. They're reporters." Lachlan's eyes have gone wide. His hand goes to his mouth.
"What if the child catcher got him?"
"It's not the child catcher," Jack says. Ever since Lachlan watched Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, he's been terrified of the child catcher, A villain who lures children into a cage by offering them lollipops and sweets. There are lots more questions about the police and the reporters outside. I can see Lachlan is struggling the most.
Does that mean he's gone forever?
No.
So where is he?
He's staying with some other family.
Like a sleepover,
says Lucy.
No, not quite.
My heart wants to break. Ben has a new home and he's being looked after by someone else.
But why?
Asks Lachlan. I don't know how to answer him.
Won't he miss us?
Lucy asks. Jack comes to my rescue. The person who took Ben is sad. She is so sad that she thought a baby might make her happy, even if it's someone else's baby.
Why can't she have her own baby?
Lachlan asks. We don't know, says Jack, but we're going to get Ben back.
When?
Soon.
Tomorrow?
Maybe not tomorrow.
Snack time,
I announce, clapping my hands. Who wants oven chips?
Yeah,
they chorus. Jack carries Lucy to the kitchen, which he doesn't do much anymore because she's grown so big. I carry Lachlan, sniffing his hair, drawing his smell deep into my lungs, wanting to remind myself that these two are safe and belong to me. It's strange having Jack at home during the day. His boss has given him indefinite leave from work, but Jack doesn't know what to do with himself. I can manage to fill each hour with chores, cooking, cleaning, and sewing buttons, while Jack wanders through the house, looking out of the window, checking his emails, looking out of the window again. Normally he'd play tennis or go for a run, but everything we do is being monitored, recorded, and broadcast. The reporters outside are knocking on our neighbors' doors, asking to use their bathrooms or looking for quotes. At the same time, photographers and cameramen have set up stepladders so they can shoot over our box hedge at the bay window and front door. Our house is the backdrop for hourly updates, delivered breathlessly by journalists, while the bright lights blast through our front curtains, casting shadows on the walls. We're trapped in here. We're like rats in a cage or goldfish in a bowl. Last night, Jack and I lay in bed like strangers, staring at the ceiling. At one point, his knee touched my thigh, and I slid another few inches away from him. He uttered a gentle snore, and I resented him even more. Eventually, I slept. Ben appeared in my dreams. I heard him crying, and my milk came in, and I wondered how my heart could keep beating of its own accord when it felt so broken and mangled. Every 4 hours I have been expressing and putting the milk in the freezer, adding to my growing supply, hoping it will be necessary. I woke to the sound of reporters laughing outside, making jokes. I know from Jack how journalists find humour in the darkest stories, because it inoculates them against tragedy, or overcomes the boredom. They make jokes about Jimmy Savile and Rolf Harris, and Boris Johnson and Donald Trump. Nothing is off-limits or too soon. The TV is a constant soundtrack as I follow every bulletin, listening to the endless parade of childcare experts, doctors, hostage negotiators, and bereaved parents who are asked to comment on the investigation and how Jack and I might be feeling. Our friends are also asked to comment, ambushed as they step out of their cars or front doors. Startled by the cameras, they mouth sympathetic platitudes, adding nothing, filling airtime. There have been dozens of unconfirmed sightings up and down the country. New mothers are complaining about being stopped by strangers in the street, who peer into their prams and quiz them suspiciously. Occasionally, something new emerges. A hospital blanket was discovered in a toilet cubicle at King's Cross Station. The tartan shopping trolley turned up on a train that arrived in Edinburgh. A cleaner took it home, thinking it was abandoned, but saw the trolley mentioned on the news and handed it over to police. So Ben is in Scotland, I said to Annie.
We don't know that.
But the trolley?
It might have been left on the train. There are 7 stops between King's Cross and Edinburgh.
So he could be anywhere.
We're checking the CCTV footage and ticket purchases from those stations.
I'm trying to stay positive, modulating my voice to sound low and reasonable whenever I talk to the police,
but inside I'm screaming, just find him for God's sake. In the meantime, the cards and letters keep arriving. The postman came twice today, delivering 3 sacks each time. Annie has suggested she read everything first in case one of the messages is from the kidnapper, but I think she's trying to protect us from the trolls. Already there are conspiracy theories appearing on the internet. Someone has suggested the kidnapping is a hoax to raise Jack's profile. Others say that an organized crime syndicate was behind the abduction, trafficking white children to slave traders in the Middle East. I shouldn't read the crazies. My imagination has enough material. Annie suggests we go and stay with my parents. You said the kidnapper might try to make contact? We could put a transfer on your numbers. What if they tried to bring Ben home? Annie doesn't answer, but I know she thinks I'm clutching at straws. I don't care. I'm allowed to be irrational or insanely optimistic. What I refuse to do is lose hope. Lucy has gone to school today, but Lachlan is staying home because I need the distraction. Neither of them has mentioned baby Ben since yesterday. I don't think they're unmoved or uncaring. That's the difference between children and adults. Children don't put as much energy into being sad. I have my laptop open on the kitchen bench and have been searching the internet for other stories of missing children. When Madeline McCann disappeared, the circus ran for months and then years. Jack gets angry when I mention facts like this. It's not the same, he says. We're going to find Ben. Right now he's upstairs, sitting in an airless study, watching football or playing computer solitaire. Or maybe he's also searching the internet, looking for solace or reassurance or a clue. Dr. Haven wants to come over, says Annie, cupping her mobile phone in her hands. He's finished the psychological profile. When? He can be here in 15 minutes. Okay, I say, desperate for any news. It's not boredom I feel so much as ineffectiveness. I want to be doing something useful or positive that might make a difference. Annie is brushing her hair and applying lip gloss in the hallway mirror. I wonder if it has anything to do with Cyrus Haven. How well do you know him? I ask. Who? Dr. Haven. Not very well. Oh, I thought you might be friends. Annie colours slightly, and I know that I'm on the right track. Either she carries a torch for Cyrus, or there has been a past relationship. How did you meet him? I ask. He interviews officers who are involved in shootings or who are injured in the line of duty. Did that happen to you? She nods. I'm not supposed to talk about it. Her reluctance makes me even more curious. He's a very interesting man, Dr. Haven. A good listener. I guess he has to be. But he also strikes me as being very sad. That's understandable, says Annie. Why? After what he went through. What happened to him? It's not really my place. I open my laptop and call up Google, typing in the name Cyrus Haven. You won't find anything, says Annie. Why not? She chews the inside of her cheek. You didn't hear this from me, okay? I nod. Look up the name Elias Haven Sykes. Dozens of links appear on screen with dramatic shout lines. Family hacked to death. Youngest son discovers family massacre. Haven Sykes committed to mental hospital. Opening some of the links, I read them in silence. Elias Haven Sykes, aged 18, used a machete to murder his parents and 2 younger sisters in Manchester in 1995. One member of the family survived, Cyrus Haven Sykes, aged 13, who came home from football practice and discovered his brother watching TV while resting his feet on their father's body. Their mother lay dead on the kitchen floor. His sisters had tried to barricade themselves in a bedroom, but were dragged from beneath their beds and hacked to death. Annie had been watching me read. Why? I whisper. Elias was a diagnosed schizophrenic. He'd been in and out of psychiatric hospital since he was 16. Where is he now? Rampton, as far as I know. Maximum security. Does Cyrus ever talk about him? No. I close the computer
not wanting to read any more. I remember the case now, but not the names of those involved. One image in particular flashes into my mind. The photograph of a teenage boy dressed in a black suit, standing alone amid the coffins of his family. The caption called him the loneliest boy in the world. Cyrus arrives at midday. He is so unprepossessing and unremarkable that the reporters ignore him until the last moment when he's nearing the front door. One of them calls his name. The others are soon scrambling out of cars and vans, but the door has closed by then, and Cyrus is shrugging off his leather jacket. Annie hangs it up for him. Their hands touch, and a look passes between them. I make a pot of tea, which Cyrus doesn't drink. He seems to enjoy the ritual of tea, but not the taste. "Where's Jack?" he asks. "Upstairs." "How is he? What does he want me to say? Jack is struggling and I can't help him and I don't know if I want to. I know it's not fair or rational to blame Jack, but since when is life fair?" I say none of this out loud, but sense that Cyrus hears it anyway. As if summoned, Jack arrives in the kitchen. He takes a seat and accepts a cup of tea, staring at the milky brown liquid as though trying to remember what it's called. Cyrus takes a single sheet of paper from his satchel. He puts it on the table and centers it between his elbows. A forefinger pushes his reading glasses higher on the bridge of his nose. "This is what I've told the police," he says. "They're looking for a woman in her 30s or early 40s who was comfortable in a hospital setting, blending in and interacting with patients and visitors without attracting attention or being deterred. She was also familiar with the layout of the Churchill, the stairwells, lifts and cameras, which suggests that she has worked at the hospital or visited it previously. The police are checking employment records and older CCTV tapes." Cyrus moves his finger down the page. "She is an accomplished liar, which might sound obvious, but it's not easy to lie when the stakes are this high. Most people will show evidence of the stress. They will blush or stammer or perspire or fidget, but this woman was very cool under pressure. I think she has a high degree of intelligence that might not be reflected in her level of education." "What do you mean?" asks Jack, who is folding a paper towel into smaller and smaller squares. "High intelligence doesn't always equate to academic achievement. She may not have had the opportunity or the application necessary to go beyond secondary school, but she's clearly very clever. Look at the planning involved, the different disguises, the precautions, the verbal and non-verbal behaviour, and her interactions with people like you." "So we're dealing with a criminal mastermind," Jack says sarcastically. Cyrus doesn't react. "Not a mastermind, but a clever woman who didn't appear lost or nervous or frightened. One who has spent months planning this crime. You're making excuses for the hospital, giving them a way out." I interject. "That's not what Cyrus is saying. He's calling her a genius." "I'm giving you a psychological profile," says Cyrus. "I don't make excuses for people. I try to understand them. Normally, when I look at a crime scene, I see the limitations of the perpetrator. Almost always, they fail because of their inability to plan ahead. They concentrate on the crime, but not their exit strategy. They get impatient and stop short of working out what happens next. In this case, the woman planned everything in meticulous detail. How to secure a baby, and how to get away. She didn't improvise or say, 'Oh well, if I get that far, I'll wing it.' She had an extra disguise. She had the trolley. She must have heard the alarm go off. She knew they were looking for her. The hospital was a labyrinth. The exits were being sealed off, but she didn't panic, or run, or draw attention to herself. It took police days to discover how she smuggled baby Ben out of the hospital." He pauses, waiting for Jack to respond or comment. When there's no reply, he continues. "The perpetrator is likely to be married or in a relationship, but not a stable one. This is one of the reasons she wants a baby, to cement a relationship, to make a man stay with her who she fears might leave. She's willing to take risks. Through each step of the abduction, the chance of discovery increased, but she carried on. changing her clothes, walking the corridor, penetrating the heart of the hospital. At any point, a member of staff could have questioned her credentials or raised the alarm.